Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Sue Miller, whose latest novel is The Senator's Wife. Earlier novels include The Good Mother, Family Pictures, Inventing the Abbots, While I Was Gone, one memoir about her father. The latest book, The Senator's Wife, deals with a philandering senator and his elderly wife and their neighbors, a young couple, well, not that young, and how they intermingle and relate with each other. According to what I read, the idea came from the thought about a wife taking an estranged husband back when he's ill. How did that idea come to you?
Actually heard a couple of people, friends of friends, who did this. In both cases, they actually had gone on and were with new partners, either married or living together, but did this anyway. It just was so striking to me and such an extraordinary behavior, I thought, so generous and so complicated. And it just made me ponder it, sort of a what-if situation. And I began to think about taking care of my father and the way in which tending to someone makes you feel loving toward them, that actually physically taking care of someone, touching someone, allows you to feel that. And then I thought about how the other context in which that's true for humans is with a new baby, that sort of tending a little tiny baby and the kind of attention it requires, physical attention and the kind of physical contact with it, is very encouraging to that paternal or whatever the relationship is, to the bond between the adult and the child. So I began to think about the possibilities as I sort of thought this through a little more, that I would have two women living close to each other. As it turned out, they live on each on one side of a double house. They're in the same physical structure, but with a party wall between their living spaces, one of whom is taking care of a child at the very beginning of life and one of whom is taking care of an adult at the very end of life, and sort of look at those two things and sort of play around with the differences and the similarities between them. And as it worked out, I initially thought that the older woman would have the much harder task. But as it works out in this book, that's not the case. And in fact, the younger woman who's having a harder time feeling a sense of affection and attachment to them.
And in addition, it turns out that the section where the older woman takes care of the estranged husband is very, very brief.
Yes, yeah.
But that happens, I guess, a lot in turning any idea into a novel.
That it gets altered along the way.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yes, very much so. Yeah. I mean, what originally sparks the thinking often actually gets discarded along the way sometimes also.
The senator is a two-term liberal senator from an unnamed New England state.
Yes.
Who's a philanderer. Of course, the names that come up are the Clintons, Gary Hart, Ted Kennedy, though the time frame says Paul Tsongas.
Mm. It's nobody. I mean, he's obviously invented. There's a lot of, sort of for me in the book, a lot of speculation about privacy and public life and privacy itself and a private kind of personality as opposed to a more borderless sort of personality. And I decided that it would be interesting to have the reason why the senator and his wife have separated in the past be not just one relationship. There is one relationship in particular which causes them to separate. He's had multiple affairs. But to have it happen in a time when this didn't necessarily get discussed publicly, so that Delia, my character, who is the senator's wife, would be essentially complicit, as were, let's say, Jackie Kennedy or Eleanor Roosevelt, in maintaining the fiction, which is the very thing which wounds them. I mean, they have to participate in the lie about it, the public lie about it. And that seemed compelling and interesting to me, too, as a sort of thing to look at with this sort of public-private thing that I was horsing around with.
Well, when you did that, did you read about Ted and Joan? And have you read about the Clintons? I mean, I'm trying to get an idea of what it's like inside.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, you know, to me at least, Hillary Clinton is so opaque you can't really see anything.
I wouldn't have a guess as to what the relationship is really like, whether there's a bargain implicit in something going on between them. I come from Massachusetts, and I was very aware of Chappaquiddick and the Kennedy debacle at that point. It was just so awful. But one of the things which interested me most and astonished me most about it was that Joan Kennedy did campaign with Ted Kennedy immediately after, or very shortly after that event in which a young woman was killed. And then subsequently they divorced. But the idea that she stayed with him through that was very stunning to me and amazing to me.
And trying to find, I guess, the reasons why Delia, your senator's wife, would do what she did. I mean, how many times did you stop and go, how the hell could she have put up with it? But she did. And then try to figure out motivations.
Well, you know, I've known people of that generation who have put up with it, as opposed to Hillary Clinton, who has many options besides being married to Bill Clinton. I think of, you know, several women that I knew who were friends of my parents who endured, you know, being left for a while by husbands who had relationships but waited and the husbands came back. And I think, you know, in part, Delia's a person who, as she's thinking back over her young life and, you know, graduated from college, that she expected to marry a man who would take care of her, who would take care of her well. And she's thought that Tom was this man. So that some of it is that she doesn't see herself as having a lot else that she can turn to. She's got children with him, and she loves him, what's more. And he actually loves her. I mean, so there's that terrible conundrum that he is incapable of fidelity over the long haul. I mean, he has some years when he's capable of it and does better than other times. But she can sense that he loves her. She feels confident of that, actually. And she feels that way about him also. And she doesn't have good other options, although finally she does leave him, in fact.
Well, she does have options in terms of going off to Paris and living her own life. Of course, these days she might choose to be a politician herself.
Yes.
The sense I got was that one of the reasons she stuck with him is because she believed in what he believed in.
Absolutely. I mean, she consents to campaign with him, as Joan Kennedy did, because that part of his life is a part of his life that she admires him for extremely.
Had you always wanted to make this a liberal Democrat rather than a Republican because it removes certain levels of hypocrisy? Or was it just because of your history?
I think it's just because I was more compelled to write about such a person than I would have been about a Republican, probably. I was interested in sort of the life of someone in political life at that time. And I read about, the person I chose to read about was a biography of Daniel Patrick Moynihan, because I saw him as having some background rather like Tom. And I saw him also as having some of the difficulties that Tom has when, you know, the liberal left becomes the new left, and he is capable of doing it, but he doesn't enjoy doing it, the kind of multiple constituencies that he has to respond to and the kinds of ways he has to do this fancy dance, he calls it, essentially.
Well, Sue Miller, you also apparently read the multiple life stories in your father's alumni records.
Wow, you have done your research.
Your father taught church history, which is kind of unusual, too. So
what they do at his college is every 5 years they collect these stories from all the members of each class and publish a volume. So you have these. I've used it more than once when I'm writing about people of my parents' generation, because you have these reports from these men, and they do all kinds of things. I mean, they're in all walks of life. You just have to thumb through and find a person who's sort of living a life that you've assigned to your fictional character, and you can get a 5-year report on how maybe 3 or 4 of these guys lived their lives and thought about their children and thought about what they were doing and how they were voting and how they felt about the Second World War and how they, you know, just a really interesting ongoing account that I think they stopped publishing at their 50th reunion.
So each of the alumni just wrote like a few pages every...
Or some of them just write a paragraph. Some of them, not many of them, write a few pages. Most of them sort of just write several paragraphs to sort of report in on what their lives are like and, you know, what their marriage is like to some degree. And some of them are very sort of heartfelt and wrenching. I mean, they report on great disappointments, tragedies. There was a guy who was a prisoner of war in the Second World War who is the most buoyant personality you can imagine as you trace his life through. But you get this kind of wonderful, abbreviated, self-reported version of a person doing a particular thing in life. And it's just a tremendous resource. And I read it sometimes just for fun.
When you're reading it, you know, you're a writer. You've taken writing classes. We know about voice. Do you get that strong sense of voice from these writers, these people?
there's a sort of stylized voice that they do this in. There's a kind of expectation of the tone they'll take, I think, although they don't all take any particular tone. But there's a particular way of writing. And that, too, changes over time, though, and becomes what I would call more natural over time, as those sort of strictures about the way one does this and the way one does that fall away. But there's not really usually a strong written voice in it. It's more a kind of repertorial voice.
In your research, you also, I understand that you taught a prison writing class and you used that material?
I didn't do that for this book, but I used it because I'd done it, yeah.
But you did go on a tour of Emily Dickinson's home to try to get a sense of what a docent does.
Yes. Yeah. Delia is a docent in a fiction writer's house. Early 19th century, so a little bit earlier than Emily Dickinson, but it was a great fun to go through the house and just sort of listen to the docent. The house itself was fascinating, and just the sort of sense of her life being lived there, and then the life of her brother next door. I mean, we did go into that house, too.
How about the creation of the fictional writer?
I actually had more of her writing, which I cut because I think the book was sort of a little too long at the point I was about to hand it in. But I, you know, invented a novel that she wrote and invented a life out of which she wrote the novel, a set of concerns that she had, and invented, you know, letters, which I had more of also in an earlier draft of the book. But I used a quite wonderful book called The Peabody Sisters by Megan Marshall to get sort of the voice of that time down. They wrote letters, many, many letters to each other, which are quoted in Megan Marshall's book and are wonderful to read.
The woman who winds up pregnant, the next door neighbor, mm-hmm. she goes into the house and finds letters mm-hmm. and she's a voyeur and reads them. Mm-hmm. It's an interesting device because it allows you to give the history and at the same time work with Mary as a character
yes.
as well.
Yeah.
How did that idea emerge?
I had it at the start. I mean, it's part of why I made Delia a docent who exposes these other letters. I mean, she actually expresses some hesitance about making this very private life public and showing all these letters that this woman wrote. As she said, you know, who would have had the right to expect that the only person who would ever see them would be the person to whom they were addressed. But it did seem to me, first of all, to suggest a kind of personality that I was interested in, that Mary is a person who really doesn't feel the kind of boundaries that Delia feels. Delia is a very formal in many ways. I mean, she's very charming and outgoing, but she finally has a kind of reserve and a withdrawn part of herself that she doesn't show to Mary in particular, but to lots of others. And Mary is a person who wants stuff from people. She's kind of a greedy person. I liked her very much. I don't think she's greedy in every aspect of her life. I think she's very generous in some of them. But she's compelled by Delia and also feels that sense of being held away by Delia that you do feel, I think, around such people. And it sort of happens slowly over time, but she does end up reading Delia's correspondence with Tom, or Tom's letters to Delia is what she reads. And that was just part of this, you know, this whole notion of public and private that I was really interested in thinking about. What rights we do have to anyone else's inner thoughts. I mean, even the question of marriage. I mean, early on in the book, Mary is thinking that she's feeling some resistance to her very new husband, Nathan, and is thinking, you know, in order to be fully honest in this marriage, she would have to sort of argue and talk with him about every little thing that she disagrees with him about. And she feels the impossibility of that. And I think we all understand the impossibility of that, of any kind of true, deep honesty with anyone else. It's not possible because we would spend all of our time explaining ourselves. So, you know, this was just part of this, you know, one step along this very wide spectrum of the issue of privacy versus exposing oneself, you know, boundaries versus no boundaries.
Why did you make Mary a late marriage, late baby person?
I wanted her to have had a full life. I wanted her to be someone for whom the pregnancy, which is unexpected, represents sort of some risk to a life that she's at some pains established for herself. Even the marriage represents some risk to that life, and she's aware of feeling it as a little bit of a threat. Because I decided I wanted her to have sort of these difficulties with the baby. So it seemed to be more likely that someone who had, you know, struggled to make a life for herself, which she has, and who's sort of made a successful life and finally, and actually has this job, very new job that she turns out she really loves, that I wanted that to be sort of threatened by her pregnancy and then by the new baby who comes.
It's interesting. I was reading an old interview you did for a novel published in 1999 called While I Was Gone, and there are three quotes about the book, but they're more general, and it's interesting reading The Senator's Wife and going back to something you wrote almost a decade ago. You wrote, "With each work, I feel I'm playing around with the idea of self. To what degree is self something we will?" And it strikes me in the case of Delia, for sure, this question comes up yet again.
Yes. I mean, Delia is very conscious of, and I think because she sort of rescues herself several times, she's conscious of needing to control the self that she presents to the world and needing to reassert and reshape the self that she presents to the world when various things happen to her.
When I was reading the book, and as we talk here, it strikes me that it must have been, in a way, hard to try to maintain the balance between Mary and Delia, because Delia is so much more interesting as a character.
I think she is, too. You know, I did much more with sort of Mary's life in the world than I did with Delia's, so that, you know, that was part of it. But then what happens in the book, actually, is that Mary become so compelled by Delia. I mean, thus it's called The Senator's Wife, not, you know, not Mary and Delia or something like that. So that, in effect, a lot of what goes on with Mary is pondering about Delia and exploring things about Delia and thinking about Delia, in fact.
Another quote I have, which applies to several of your books, not all of them, "I don't think that marriage is a cure for human restlessness." That's another quote, and that, boy, that really hits home in this book. Because I kept wondering, you know, someone like Tom, the senator, he would have to get married for political reasons, but he's not someone who necessarily should get married.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. And I think, you know, in a more modern world, he might not have to get married for political reasons and might not have married even. But, you know, I think his marrying really is a mistake in a lot of ways.
But absolutely necessary given...
Given the times.
Given the times and who he is.
Yes.
He has
and the
to
fact
married.
That he really loves Delia, too. There's that, I think, and wants to have a family.
And keeps going back to her and promises fidelity, and she believes him a little bit too often.
I think some of the time he manages it for a while, but in the end he doesn't.
Another quote from While I Was Gone, which is about the character Joe, who comes close to committing adultery, is, "Women's lives are shaped more like men's these days." And I kept thinking of that as opposed to before. And I kept thinking of that in relation to Mary and Delia, that Mary is more capable of living in the man's world than Delia is.
Yes. I mean, in every way. I mean, she's worked. She's supported herself. She's had a sort of active sexual life in a way that Delia really hadn't at all before she married Tom. And her sort of sense of herself as she moves through the world is much, much more like the sense of a man as he moves through the world than Delia's ever was. I mean, her way of moving through the world was entirely different from that. And I think that that has changed enormously and has altered things between men and women enormously for their lives to really be much more similar than they once were. I think, you know, there was a kind of clear definition of, for instance, in marriage, of the roles that people would play at one point. And now nothing is clear about the roles people are going to play. They need to make those rules themselves. I mean, sure, there are some marriages in which those roles are very clear. I think for women who, sort of educated women who work, that's not the case.
And this comes out of, I guess, the success of the women's movement.
Yes, I think so, yeah. But it complicates things enormously, and I think probably sometimes interestingly and probably sometimes in a way that's just a pain in the ass.
You're listening to an interview with Sue Miller, whose latest novel is The Senator's Wife. Before going into a little about your own past, one more question, which is most of your early books, maybe all of them, dealt with first person, and then you've moved on to writing from a third person.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about that? Do you think that it's a deepening of your own writing, or just that you moved on because you got bored?
No, and in fact, only the first book was first
really?
Person, and then another one called The World Below, which is a rather late book. I mean, the Family Pictures, which was my second novel, was partially first person and partially third, and then the third novel was entirely third.
Okay.
So I think I've moved around pretty fluidly and not – I very much needed to write my first novel in the first person, I think. That, you know, I was sort of teaching myself how to do certain things, and the immediacy of that voice was very helpful to me. But then I think I felt I'd learned enough that I could do the third person. And Family Pictures was kind of a confusing book to write yeah. because of that, and my own decisions didn't get made until late, and there's a lot of revising I had to do.
Well, I think when you're writing first person, you get very – first of all, voice is easier,
mm-hmm.
and you get very focused, whereas with third person, even a tight third person – you have to kind of look around more.
Yes, yeah. And I enjoy that. I mean, there's certainly, I think, one of the liabilities of first person is that you are trapped by perspective. I mean, there's only one person's perspective you can give, only one person's take on things. And it also controls what you can sort of reveal about what's actually happening, so that if the person misunderstands things, you have to find some way to convey that via first person, which is complicated, I think, sometimes.
And you wanted to make sure in this book, for instance, that you had both characters' perspective.
Yes.
Going back to your career, you didn't publish until 86, and that was The Good Mother,
right.
which was a success. You did write a first unpublished novel, and what I read is that you said the problem with it is nothing much happened, and then you read The Brothers Grimm?
Well, not quite in that. I mean, I actually wrote two unpublished
okay.
novels. But I, you know, I think that the notion that you should tell a story is something that is the way I feel about writing at this point, writing novels. And I think that the quickness with which the Brothers Grimm sort of just tell you what's happening, what the situation is, and just suggest what the drama is going to be is something that was useful for me to look at. I've suggested it also to students when I've been teaching writing that, you know, just you need to have that much sense of the tension in the story. And the Brothers Grimm get to it rather quickly. There once was a man whose wife was a shrew, who, you know, that kind of thing.
You grew up in a family, sounds like a large family of ministers and academics.
Mm-hmm.
How do you think that's affected your writing overall?
Well, I think it probably gave me a sense that writing was important from the get-go. Even as a little kid, you know, I went to church every Sunday and listened to a sermon and came to recognize that the sermon had a particular shape and predictability and rhythm to it. And so, you know, in a sense, understood something about the formal demands of writing sort of by osmosis, just by sitting there in that pew and having to listen. And then also learned early on that this could be well done or it could be less well done. I mean, my family was nothing if not judgmental about sermons in the same way that, you know, writers are judgmental about other books. So that the sense of kind of shapeliness and beauty in the form was also there for me. So I think those are important. I think also the sense of reading scripture and of understanding that, say, a parable, you know, there's the surface meaning of something, and then there's the reaching down on the anagogical meaning of something, the meaning that it has for the spiritual life of the people involved or the spiritual life of the listener. And I think that's very important for a fiction writer to understand that, you know, you write a story, and you need to write a story, is my feeling, but it should have these kind of this other life that might speak to the inner life of the reader.
How conscious do you think that underlying tale, the meaning behind the parable, should be for the writer or for you?
I think the way in which it's conscious for me is has to do with the things that I'm interested in exploring in the book, such as the notion of privacy, such as the notion of marriage. I'm raising questions about those things. Not that I'm resolving them, I don't think, at all. And I don't think much gets resolved about them in this book. But for me, that it there's a kind of other life to the story for me, too. It may not be exactly the other life that a reader would take away from the story, but I hope that there is something about the way we live now, the way that has changed from ways we've lived in the past, and the ways in which that affects who we are and who we can present to other people, the connections we can make to other people.
I don't think writing is therapy on the one hand, but on the other hand, do you think it changes the writer? Do you think that writing these books has changed you by virtue of having written those specific books?
Oh, I'm sure it has, yeah. I'm not sure exactly how, but I'm sure that it has sort of made me speculate about things and seen myself as like certain characters and not like certain characters. I mean, I try to imagine being all of the characters that I write about so that in a certain way I call up various aspects of myself and probably recognize them as I'm calling them up.
I know some writers have this bizarre synchronicity where events in the books sometimes seem to parallel events in their own lives in weird ways. Has that ever happened to you?
A few times, yeah, a few times. And actually, in this book, it's very interesting that at this point, my son is about to have a baby. So, I sort of feel this. And I had bought the book, What to Expect When You're Expecting to Read, for the passages, which, I mean, not that I haven't had a baby. But actually, it turns out things are very different around that issue, too. But I bought it to read for this book and then was able to give it to my daughter-in-law so that she could have it as a resource as she's sort of going through this pregnancy.
Well, one would hope she wouldn't read The Senator's Wife to get an idea of what birth is like.
No, I hope. Well, it's not going to be that way for her anyway, but she, because she's having a cesarean. But I said to her, are you sure? She wanted the book, and I said, are you sure? And I sort of told her what happens in it, and she said she still did, so.
Sue Miller, several of your books have been made into films, two of them for the big screen, Inventing mm-hmm. the Abbots and The Good Mother. How do you feel about those movies, and did you have any involvement in them?
My son was in college at the time The Good Mother was being filmed. It was filmed partially on location in Cambridge, which was where he was going to school. So we went down. We were extras one day on the set, but that was really my connection with that film. I had a little more connection with Inventing the Abbots, but nothing to speak of. I mean, they sort of showed me the script, and I made a few comments on it, but that was it. And I haven't seen either of them, so that I can't comment on them.
Really? Yeah. And that's deliberate?
That is deliberate, yeah.
There's also two TV movies, mm-hmm. When I Was Gone and Family Pictures. Mm-hmm. Any connection? And you haven't seen those either, I take it, yeah. Sue Miller, have you worked in the short story format?
I published a collection of short stories. Inventing the Abbots is, in fact, a collection of short stories. But I haven't written a short story in quite a long time. And I think even when I was writing those early short stories, my sense of myself was that I was a novelist. And I did them because my life was hectic and chaotic, and I was a single mother at the time. And then it was just hard for me to imagine launching myself into a novel right at that moment. And so the form of the short stories seemed manageable, that I could actually finish a few of them, whereas the novel did not.
And the memoir?
The memoir is about my father. It's called The Story of My Father. He died of Alzheimer's disease, and I was his caregiver, essentially. He was in a home, but I was the person living close by and his sort of real human contact. When he was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease, there just weren't books that were helpful to me. My instinct is always to find the book that will help me understand things. There were very, very technical medical books, and then there were very sort of sappy self-help kind of books, I thought. And so I wanted to write a book for the reader that would explain the disease very clearly, and that would talk about some of the issues that face, the moral issues that face a caregiver, the kind of confusions that you have about the way you should respond to the other person's confusion, and to talk about my father and who he'd been. I was trying to do multiple things in the book. I think I succeeded fairly well, but it's a little bit hard to describe as a book because it does sort of move around among these various ambitions, as it were. But I think it does do all of them to some degree.
Well, when you're writing a memoir, it also means you kind of have to be more naked than you would be in a novel.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. You know, the first-person narrator is you for a change, is me for a change. And that, too, was difficult for me, the sort of decision-making about how far forward I wanted to come as a as a person, and, you know, how restrained to be, sort of what needed to be there and what didn't in order to make the book real. It was hard for me to find my place, but I finally did.
Yeah, I keep thinking that if I were to write a memoir, the hard thing would not be writing it for strangers to read, but writing it for people who knew me mm-hmm. and what they would say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there is that consciousness of that, you know, people are going to know if you fraudulently represent yourself. They're going to, you know, your brother is going to say to you, oh, well. So there is that awareness.
Sue Miller, at this point, have you begun working on another novel,
yes,
the idea
yeah.
behind it?
Yeah. I mean, I've turned this one in, I guess I turned it in finally, with the revisions in March, I think. So it's been a long time since I stopped working on it. I mean, it's come back and forth with copy editing and things like that and galley reading. But no, I get very restless if I don't have something that I'm doing.
All of your books deal with marriage and family issues. And you've been quoted as saying you think too many books get away from that and seem to ignore that. Do you think that we need to focus just generally more on the personal, just in how we think of the world? Do you think that's a problem or not?
It seems to me there's a tremendous focus on the personal, sort of personal growth and sort of the transformation of the person becoming the person you want to be and all of this. And there's sort of less interest in looking at the complexity of personhood, maybe, is, I don't know, I'm not sure I'm saying this very well, but the kind of ways in which we will do what we will do, whether or not it's good for us, the kinds of ways in which we behave that are not optimal, I think, and that we're likely to go on doing, the humankind is likely to go on doing forever, it seems to me. I think there are things we can change about ourselves without doubt, but I think we come in a certain way, we arrive in a certain way, and I think that's something worth recognizing.
You've been listening to an interview with Sue Miller, whose latest novel is The Senator's Wife. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.